Hardacre Institute of Jewish Studies. She received her rabbinic ordination from Yeshivat Maharat, which is Avi Weiss's rabbinical school for women. So Maharat is the term that they're using for women who become rabbis, and some will get and use the term rabbis soon. You go right. Yeah. You have it?
Yeah, I do.
But just leave a couple over there for the people who come that way. Jay and Bobby were using the sheets that I circulated last time, mostly compiled by Yaffa Epstein, and she has studied at the Pardes Kollel, the Advanced Talmud Institute at Matan, and the Talmud Department at Hebrew University. So, needless to say, I point it out because you have women, thank God, these days, learning all kinds of Talmud and that are part of the Jewish studies world. And she's done a lot of teaching around the world.
We've been doing it a long time.
And right, and that's to say that the Beit Midrash structure, in terms of the Beit Midrash programs that are open to women studying, in some ways, you know, if you think about the age of Or Zeruah and the age of how many Beit Midrash programs or Bate Midrash have been open for women since, if you want to include the 70s when the Hebrew Union College started ordaining women, that you could say that there have not been major places of women's studies. Of course, that's if you want to exclude some of the kind of school systems that were created for the study of Chumash, especially the Torah, where women study those things to become teachers for the religious school systems that were around for a long time. And you touched on rabbinic literature, of course, because in commentaries, you always had rabbinic literature within the context. But if you want to talk about the timing of Or Zeruah and the timing of institutions that were creating either engagement with Talmudic literature or Talmudic scholarship is really what I'm talking about when I talk about Yaffa, it's not that many decades old. The question is, were there women who learned, though, in Talmudical academies? Were there women who had access to those places? And part of the reason I bring you the sources that we have today is because you'll see that there was some real accent on the women who had achieved entree into the world of rabbinic learning, particularly Bruria, the wife of Rabbi Meir, daughter of Hananya ben Tradion. And not every time do we have a story about women doing mitzvot and women being righteous and praying in a way that matters, just like the men of the culture. Not every time do we attribute it just directly to Bruria, even though some of the actions sound a little bit familiar in terms of how Bruria acted and what she did and how she had faith and what she believed in terms of the culture of women and their connection.
Was the reason that women could study other things or do other things and not specifically Talmud?
Well, there's a long history in that's located in the Gemara, in Masechet Kedushin, that obviously is playing out a conversation that is ages older than the pages of the Talmud itself. When it says in the Shema, Vishinantam livanecha vidibartavam. You shall teach them. Livanecha, to your son, if you want to be very exact about it. Vidibartavam, and you will speak about them, the words of Torah. Then maybe all learning is only to the ben, and lo laba, and not to the daughter. This is part of what's in Kiddushin. And part of what's in there is this ripe discussion of, let's consider whether or not women could have a place at the table. And let's consider, a la some of the commentaries around the pages, what women were doing in terms of learning, or in terms of tefillin, let's say, in the Middle Ages. So that the living pages of Gemara became places where, yes, we're willing to have the conversation that ultimately opens the door for us to converse about this issue, about this matter, and open the doors further in terms of the Beit Midrash. We know up to the modern era, if you will, that women were definitely included in learning halakha, in law, especially the law about creating a Jewish home. We know that biblical studies as teachers were important within that world, because the Rambam already relates to the fact that there's this question of learning Torah and biblical material versus Talmudic material. And then many discussions over the ages. You know, there's bias on behalf of men that women's minds are light. You see this phrase in...
You
can keep looking at those examples and using them and putting them forward as every good reason why they should be judges, doctors, lawyers, rabbis, and Talmudic scholars. But that's not the way in general halachic authorities ultimately opined throughout centuries.
But there's a pathetic fallacy that's the basis of that behind that argument, that they can yet trust these light-headed women to raise the children.
Well, right. It's,
and it's the children who they all say you have to teach.
It's a total fallacy, and
so the argument is sort of dull.
What I'm also showing is that the exceptions are the rules. In my opinion, and I'm not the first to say this, but it was in a little bit of a way of thinking about women's voices in Talmud from my teacher, Charlotte von Robert, whose name I've mentioned before. She was at our rabbinical school and then Talmudist herself, and now is a professor at Stanford. Her claim is that the exception is the rule, meaning that you have certain women's voices and points about women's places around the table, if you will, in Talmudical terms, in Torahic terms, in Midrashic styles, that may be an example among hundreds of other ones that men seem to have either said or that are attributed to them, but that you do have certain women who are there and who do commit their lives to Torah, and who do commit their lives to halacha, and who do commit their lives to understanding what it means to be part of this culture, the culture of learning. So that's what we're discovering as we look at these sources today.
One last thing, I know you want to start, and that is just that, you know, when they started to kind of go back and look for women artists, you know, when they were trying to rediscover women who had made contributions in art, they found that previously, before the modern age, that often if there was a father who was an artist who had no sons to pass on his information to, that the daughters got the skill and became very accomplished artists. How about the rabbis that had no sons and the daughter was around? Do you have any daughters of rabbis who turned out to learn a lot and to be skilled in Talmud?
I mean, this one. This is it. Last week,
yeah,
we
but that's very late.
Late or not, again, you can talk about attributions. You can talk about having the theory that all this is exactly the time when they're presented, and all this is an editorial project. Whichever way you want to go, this is Talmudic period, and Talmudic period's literature lives orally and it lives written. So you don't have to think of it as late if it's written down 6th, 7th, 8th century. You can think of it as very alive throughout the culture of orality that exists within the classical scene of Israel, Palestinia, ancient Israel, the Yerushalmi culture, the Mishnaic culture that exists, and then the Babylonian culture. So let's go back to the first text to just simply say to Bobby, to your point, that she's the daughter of Hanani ben Tradyan. She is going to become Rabbi Meir's wife. She's in the top tier groups of scholars, and she better stated was the daughter than the son. In other words, that the daughter was asked, and she was the one to rule about this assemblage of pieces of an oven that were going to be moved to a certain place. Will it be kept kosher? Will it not be kept kosher? That's the source that we did last time as an introduction to say exactly what you're asking now. Was there a time when we turned to the daughter and not the son? And my observation here in the Tosefta is that's true. And the Tosefta is what? It is not the late source of the last editing of any kind of Talmudic material. Tosefta are brightas parallel to Mishnah that ultimately don't make it into the Mishnaic code of 200 CE, but exist. And whether or not it's really earlier material or really later material, we can't really be positive. So it could be very early material that really made its way there. Okay, so next source. Talmud Bavli Masechet Pesach. So I always like to get inspiration from tractate Pesach, Passover, when it's not necessarily right upon us and we're all so worried and nervous. I said to Jay the other night, so who knows, maybe we're going to be inspired by the tractate Passover all year next year. And we'll take parts of it throughout the year. And we'll be inspired by Passover even when you can eat bread. Something along these lines. Okay. So let's look at this story in Pesachim. Context-wise, we're talking about who can eat the Passover Korban and who can't eat the Passover Korban. And is it only circumcised people or is it uncircumcised people? And who's in a state of Tahara, who's in a state of purity and can eat, and who's in a state of Tumah? And if someone's in a state of Tumah, meaning they're impure, that's why we have Pesach Sheni. You could bring a Korban Pesach a month later if you didn't have the right kind of status to eat your Passover. I simply point that out because it will become relevant by way of the greater context of the story, of this story, that happens to appear there when they're having this discussion. Okay? So the Babylonian Talmud goes like this. Rabbi Simlai, Atal Kame de Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Simlai comes before Rabbi Yochanan and asks of him or requests of him, Amar Le, he says to him, Nitni li mar sefer yuchasin. Why don't you teach me the whole book of genealogies? Okay, so what is Sefer Yuchasin? I mean, anybody could say in general that Jews were always into genealogy. If you wanted to say a general translation of this book, the book of Yichus. You could also say that Jews were into having a little Yichus already from the start of things. Okay? You have a connection to, oh, I'm a descendant of Rashi, or I'm a descendant, they figure from Ashkenaz, a lot of people really are descendants of Rashi. You know, that descendants and being descendants of are very important in our tradition. Okay. Now, Sefer Yuchasin is another name, though, for a very specific kind of book. And it's either one of two books, according to Rashi. It's either a book of Tanaitic listings of genealogies, most likely of sage families, Tanaitic in nature, one that we don't necessarily have around or extant, by the way, so no one really says that that's the absolute truth of this request. The other is the natural request to learn Divrei Hayamim Aleph Vavet, the first Chronicles and the second Chronicles, which are the last books of the Tanakh. Right? So I'm not asking to put anybody on the spot. I think I told you last week, I've not really learned in depth First Chronicles and Second Chronicles. Okay, until this year. I have a chavruta in First Chronicles and Second Chronicles. I'm standing to show you that First Chronicles and Second Chronicles, you know, it's kind of like to say if it's in the back of the book. Well, you like to read the end, so you really should read it. But on the other hand, in the Bible, you might say, oh, it's tucked back there in writings, and it's really not something that absolutely you get to. The other time that I really did study a part of it was when Dr. David Lieber, who was my teacher in Bible in California, showed us how important this book is, these two books, now, this book, you know, first and second, because most likely they had two different scrolls. And these books at the end of the writings starting about here in terms of section of the Tanakh, right? That's the writings part. So writings, prophets, and Torah, if you've never really thought about the literature of the Bible, the prophets are for sure the part that has the most chapters and richness of history and real connection to a concrete world, in addition to prophetic poetry and wisdom and all kinds of religiosity that's defined in a post-Chumash age, in a post-Torah age. But anyway, back to the Chronicles. So they want to learn Chronicles. They want to learn Divrei Hayamim. And this request to learn it, we have to ask ourselves, why would anybody really want to learn that? And mostly we have to understand that many, many chapters of the book, to begin with, are all long genealogies. And now and then you get wonderful comments. I mentioned last week about this person being a person who was really dedicated to tshuva, or that repentance in one's life, or godliness, or this person who was really quite open to marrying someone who was not necessarily of the lineage of any of the natural kind of brothers, sisters, cousins, neighborhood, clans, and you know what happened. They got married to, as I made mention of last week, an Egyptian slave. Despite the Torah's rulings on the inner kind of relational level, despite the Torah's rulings that you really couldn't marry an Eved Mitzri, a slave who came out of Egypt, until the third generation, so that they were really integrated into the culture, you see in Divrei Hayamim already that someone married off a daughter to a male Mitzri slave, first generation, in order to keep the household intact. They wanted to keep the daughter and the son close and really there. So you have within this internal reality that the book of Divrei Hayamim, the books of Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles, are kind of saying, who is kosher to be in? And who do we really attribute proper lineage to? And how do we know that they have proper lineage? We know their ancestors. And any genealogical kind of take in Torah, because we have lists of genealogies in Torah all the time, and we have lists of genealogies throughout these books in the Bible, they're kind of asking the question, who's in and who's out? Plus, they kind of make a statement about who can we see that's an inspiring person within the whole framework of the great unfolding generations upon generations. What's a character trait that we can recognize in someone who we have to recognize as great and good? And what's a character trait or a description that we can, quote-unquote, change through halachic reality? A Mitzri, an Eved Mitzri, can become, right, an Eved Shichror, a slave that we free, in order to make that person become a ger, a full-out convert. Full-out convert. And even though ger is used in the Torah as stranger, often, you're right, that word becomes the word for convert, and we say that that person is a ger tzedek, a righteous stranger who then finds that connection, soul and culture and status within the law. So when the request comes in, teach me the book of genealogies, I want to be an expert in what? I want to be an expert in knowing who's where, who's from where, who's in, what's a person's status. Right? That's what the request really is. I want to be among the people who say, if it is about Tanaim and rabbinic sages, I want to be among the people who knows who really has the authority and who doesn't, if it's about the sages. If it's about, just in general, our people and the history and where we really can claim as ours, by the way, the scholars all say, the most important names in the group of any genealogy are the names of people who are people from a certain place and who have names that are related to a place. And that some of the most ancient literature within genealogy tables in Torah and the book of Yuchasim, the Chronicles, are those names that are place names. Not that, either that they are from such and such a place, or that their names relate to the place they lived, and that they were very ancient. And so learning this book says, oh, we have such an ancient connection. All of this is wrapped up in learning this book, and so Rabbi Simlai wants to learn it, and he requests it of Rabbi Yochanan. Marle nitni li mar sefer Yuchasim. Let's learn this book of Yuchasim. Amarle, mehechana, where are you from? Amarle, he says to him, Milod. I live near the airport.
Ready to run away.
Vehechan motavcha, and where do you live? And where do you live now? He says, Benahardea. I live in Nahardea, a city in Babylonia. What's the next question the taxi driver asks in Jerusalem? What's the next question a taxi driver lives?
Why do you live in
Nahardea? Why don't you come here? Right? We know from the great taxi drivers of Israel exactly what the next question should have been. Except, all right, here's what he says. Amar lei. He says to him, Ein dining lo lulodim v'lo l'nahardim. We do not discuss that book. We don't learn that book with Lodians and Nahardeans. Sorry. V'chol shekein De'at milud umotavcha b'Nahardea, and even more so because you're originally from Lud and now you live in Nahardea.
It's so terrible.
It's terrible. Just know it's terrible. This is the worst. Okay? This is the worst. Kfiava artsi. Amarle. Nit ne b'shlosha yarchi. But he, Rabbi Simlai, urged him, kfiya, that's like kfiya dat, you know, we use that term today, kfiya datit. How would we translate kfiya datit? Religious coercion. He coerced him. So urged is not enough of a translation here, in my estimation. I think it's coerce. He coerced him. V'aretzi, and he gave in, he consented. He said, I want to do it with you now. Amarle. So he said to him, Nit naye b'shlosha yarchi. Let's learn it in 3 months. That point, Shakal kala patach be. Rabbi Yochanan takes a clod of earth and throws it at him. He whips him. Amarle. He says to him the following. Uma Bruria. Debate to the Rabbi Meir. Barita. The Rabbi Chananya ben Tradion. I'm going to get back to that. The Tanya Talam Mea Shematitab. Yama Mishalosh Mea Rivata. Vafilu Hachilo Yatta Yedechovata. Bitalat Shani. He says, Bruria, the wife of Rabbi Meir and daughter of Rabbi Chananya ben Tradion, who studied 300 laws from 300 rabbis in one day, and even she could not fulfill her obligation to learn this book properly in 3 years. You want to learn it in 3 months? So the example here that he gives after he's coerced, after he consents, the guy says, let's do it in 3 months. Rabbi Yochanan takes a clump of earth, throws it at him. By the way, That is one of the most rebellious acts you can do as a sage. You think it's like, you know, you think it's a little thing? He throws grass in his face? No. I mean, I don't know how.
You can change his chair.
That's right, you can turn over the chair. We've already seen that.
That will be a little bit
worse. If you want to be in somebody's face in the Gemara, one of the ways you can do it is throw a clod of earth. Right? I told you about how the sages threw the clod of earth at Kodesh Baruch Hu, at God, when they were not ready for the new month to start and they wanted Rosh Hashanah to kind of, you know, hold off until we're really ready for that new moon, right? I mean, time. They're going to control time. So they throw the clod of earth up towards heaven and they say, wait, we're not ready. Yeah, that's the kind of act that's going on here. And he throws the clod of earth in his face and he says, Uma Bruria, first of all, look at Bruria. So the name comes first. Now, she's not Rabbi, she's not Rebbe, and she's not Rav. She's not Rebbe like a Tana might be called. That's a Tanaitic statement. She's not Rav. We can't expect that she's going to be called a sage's title at this point. That's not what we're saying. We're not claiming that there was any ordination of women here by this story. But we are saying she's named. Bruria. Now, what's the word for wife, you ask? De Beit Hu de Rabbi Meir. So in rabbinic terms, Ein Beit Ella Ishto is the Talmudic phrase. There's no such thing as a person having a house. There's no such thing as a person having a house, not without a wife, but there's no such thing as really having a home unless you have a wife. Your bayit is your... You can have a dwelling place. You can create the home post any kind of reality that you need. They say about divorce, they say about death, they say about situations in life where people couldn't take upon themselves the responsibility even, that you could build a bayit ne'eman. If you were a teacher and you taught children and you didn't have a family of your own, you didn't have any children, you ultimately were attributed as having children of your own in the Gemara, because they recognized that some people would just not be able to either have children physically or that they would decide to become a teacher of some sort. And that would be a mitzvah that they could do, to teach somebody something, was as if you had generations. But in general, the term represents a kind of relationship between a husband and a wife that allows them to build a bayit. Now, you don't only have that term used. You could have ishto, you could have his wife, if you're talking about in Hebrew. Isha is used. So you don't have limited amounts of terms in that sense. You can have kala, a bride, if she's a bride. But she is called here the house of Rabbi Meir. Another way to really push this translation, if I really wanted to push the translation in terms of rabbinic learning culture, you could say she's the dominant. Bruria de Beit Hu de Rabbi Meir. How do I come upon that kind of translation? First of all, she's named. She's not Ishto Shel. There's no possessive in her name at the beginning of the phrasing of her name. Two, if I say Beit in rabbinic culture, what kind of Beit am I talking about? A Beit Midrash. I'm talking about a Beit Midrash. And she becomes someone who embodies the same kind of learning culturally, vocabulary-wise, that the sages embody. She even is attributed not only to Rabbi Meir, but we get her lineage. She's not just the wife of this soul. She's mentioned as the daughter of Hananiah ben Tradyon. So that you're not going to just become the now in status terms, the wife of this person, you're the wife of that person, you're the daughter of this scholar. Ditanya tlat mea shmatata b'yoma mishalosh mea ravavta. She learned 300 laws from 300 rabbis in a day. What do you make of that phrase? What is that saying about her either possession of wisdom or her knowledge?
Perhaps it's a figure of speech.
For? I'm wondering what you make of it.
Understood that she was a paradigm of a gifted student. She learned 350, irrelevant, it's just a way of saying somebody a lot smarter than you could do it.
Tell us about her access. She's access
right.
to all these
scholars. Absolutely. She is not only in this Beit Midrash, in that rabbi's house, in her father's house, well respected, but trust me, she's learning from 300 or learning with or teaching all different kinds of sages.
It's a little bit exaggeration, but...
It is exaggeration, but it's done as a superlative or as some type of guzma, right? Because an exaggeration in the Gemara is called a guzma. And it can be, in some cases, a rhetorical kind of argument. Like if someone says something really, really outrageous, you could turn to them if you were using Beit Midrash kind of language and say, guzma! You know, you're exaggerating. You're completely... But I don't see it exactly along those terms. I think it's
to
really founded
rabbis in one day. It's not so easy, especially in Jewish tradition.
Right. So you're not talking about, you know, potentially, biyoma. You're not talking about exactly one day, but you're talking about in her lifetime. You're talking about access. You're talking about limud. You're talking about remembering limud, remembering the lessons of different sages, and afilu hachi lo yatsa yidei chovata betlat shanim. And even with all of that learning she did, she could not understand the depths and essentials and meanings and of the book you're asking to learn in 3 months. And I think that is really quite a commentary on the depth of learning that she would ultimately, or that she embodied. Now, you could read it in a way that's not kol kach l'shevach. You could read it in a way that's not entirely praiseworthy and say, aha, we're talking about Chronicles. We're talking about First Chronicles, we're talking about Second Chronicles, we're talking about potentially about a Tanaitic book concerning the sages and their lineage. However, we just heard that she learned from 300 sages, right? We just heard she was the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Meir. So I think that there's a profound sense that she is someone who learns in depth, and she takes one book of the Bible that you thought you could just read over in a couple of Shabbos afternoons and run through those lists pretty quickly, and she'll show you within the gem of that book how deep the messages are and what kind of reading you really need to read with.
Don't you think it would have more solidity to the expression of 300 bulls from 300 rabbis? We'll all agree it's some hyperbole, but
yeah.
Intent. If we had yet another statement that told us that from that she understood the right way to understand something. I'm left with an uneasy feeling that this is almost as if she's promiscuous and that she can't sit still with one or two. And because we don't have the proof of the pudding, even though you say she understood her obligation, she couldn't read genealogy in 3 years. There's something, I mean, maybe because I do start off with perhaps compared to others at this table, with more of a feminist lens in reading, there's something that leaves me very unhappy with that as just one statement. But am I modernized?
Well, look, I, yeah.
But I think if they were trying to diminish her, she wouldn't be the example to show this man.
I agree, yeah. No, the conclusion brings us there, and I absolutely agree with that. But it's the statement that we've been focusing on, and I find that not an easy statement.
Okay, so I don't see that as being bat yatsanit, like the midrashic term for a woman who just goes around. Uh-huh. She's not a yatsanit.
Uh-huh.
That there is, if you're looking at it through feminist lens, there is a sense of men's attitudes towards women are that they are yatsanit. Even if she was a yatsanit and went around, and let's say she was using that she's a little bit promiscuous. Okay.
In
the regard that it's said oftentimes in a sexual regard,
right.
And that you need to control, you know, a wife because their general inclination is to be a yatsanit, to go out and to hang out with men in the marketplace, and that we should have ma'at conversation, but
earning 300 whatever is
permissible. No, only in a very, very strong read that she was not able to really be known for one. What I'm sensing is one Beit Midrash.
She
didn't have. She didn't.
Right, Jake gave it a perfect word. It's illiterate.
She's a gypsy.
Okay.
She can't sit in one Beit Midrash and develop her reputation and hash it out over years.
I heard it differently. I heard that line is still used nowadays in my field when people, students or with I lose a lot of words still. People who are fellows,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you go to your major advisor or something, and you said you just read the New England Journal of Medicine and the JAMA, the professor's going to look at you and say, "Is that all you read?" And they'll say something nasty about it, that you haven't read enough, that you're supposed to be doing all your work. And basically, people still rate you by the amount of stuff you read, in addition to the amount of work you do. So,
right. I mean, the challenge
is that she's studying a lot. Whether it was actually 30 laws or 300 laws doesn't matter.
Right. I believe
done in 3 months.
And it's not that you didn't say this aloud, so I appreciate our being cognizant. We're going to come suspect sometimes of what the rabbis are presenting. And we're going to also have, the reason why I brought up the other attitude was because, not because I believe you have to see that everywhere, is because it does exist in texts, and you have to understand it. You know, we've...
Probably an umbrella.
Okay. We've come upon texts that are, you know, full of insults. If you learned with me in the Beit Midrash in the summer, you know, there were a bunch of insults thrown between men from different places. I mean, they're sometimes, you know, in a fight with each other. I see this not being at all suspect of her in this case, except to say, knowing all of the texts about Bruria, there's at least one, and I don't think it comes from the same authors, right? There's at least one that does depict her as being too promiscuous.
Sexually promiscuous?
Perhaps. And I'm really going to leave it at perhaps. And that is the big... That is, like, I won't get there tonight. But that is the big question if you take that as the last text. I could present that at first, okay? I could present that text at first. And since we mentioned it here and the question came up, the question about texts like these are some earlier, are some later? Are the majority of the texts the one that you're to see as the real representative of the protege, of the prodigy, of the woman sage, of the one who can retain all the answers of these various sages? And in a minute, you're going to see that she's a midrashist. My claim is that this is one of the holiest, powerful women alive, and she's an example for all women who want to ultimately be in the culture of the Beit Midrash. I don't buy that the one text that kind of plays with her as a, you know, promiscuous sort of a woman is a text that really represents her personhood at all. I think it's a comment of perhaps those sages who were a little bit jealous.
How they do it, but of course they may want to bring her down and everything. But I don't see the number. You know, whether it's this vast number or not doing the qualitative, but really the quantitative. But you know, by giving her relationship to her husband's a rabbi, her father's a rabbi, I think they're making her rather respectable and
right.
Admirable.
I think so too.
So there can be a difference of sensing what the text is saying, and I feel the same way.
I mean, basically they're saying she did all her reading and you didn't.
Yeah. I'm definitely seeing this text as very, very
this
much
guy who's asking
admiring her.
Yeah. Well, no, I think the one who's asking Similar. For this, he's the one that's suspect. He comes from a place that's suspect. He's living in a place that's suspect.
So everybody made him like this. I don't
well, in this rendition, this little
don't
paragraph.
Don't forget that most of the rabbi who left Jerusalem moved to Lod. I mean, that was the second place. So.
But he doesn't have the yichus that she has.
Correct.
That's correct. Oh, that,
they're being contrasted.
She has a big yichus. Otherwise, no rabbi will teach her.
So she's got the yichus. She's learned 300. She's gone on to read other things. And this guy comes from a bad place, and he's superficial. He wants to do it too quickly without really...
He's a genius.
So I think they're being, you know, very well contrasted, the one character with the other.
Right. Okay, so I absolutely want to point out the following when it comes to the next story. Move on to a different part in the Talmud to see where we get the proof in the pudding, as you were asking for. I don't know if you read ahead and were foreshadowing the notion that she is going to ultimately become the spokesperson for learning, like we need learning to happen in the Beit Midrash, and it's going to be about a major theological issue. It's going to be about the efficacy of prayer, very, very central to the whole rabbinic project. And it's going to be in discussion with her husband, with whom she learns Torah. And I think that kind of says what's a respectable relationship look like in terms of the Jewish people. And it's held up as an example that should at least be part of what our lives are about with our partners. But let's go on to Brachot. Okay, source number 3 on the page. Okay. Hinei hu bir yoni, dehavu vishvuta de Rabbi Meir. There were once some thugs in the neighborhood of Rabbi Meir. We have a debate about what this word bir yoni really means.
Bir yoni is a thug in Hebrew.
Bir yoni is a thug in modern Hebrew. It was borrowed from the Talmud, from this time.
It's plural.
There are other ways to translate it. Different Gemaras over time have translated it differently, and we have one that uses boars, B-O-O-R-S. We have Rashi who suggests that they were Ame Haaretz, that they were Pashtanim, they were simple folks who didn't really know any Torah. And how could they really make life happen? Bandits, groups of thieves organized in order to steal from the neighborhoods.
Which is stereo.
Okay, so when I hear thug, I kind of feel like it's someone who's violent and who's going to beat me up. When I hear bandit, I kind of hear someone who's willing to beat me up if they don't get and take what they want.
Yeah, but they are going to get all you know. They will beat you up and take it away.
Can you get?
You know, look.
Give them something and they'll go away.
That's right.
Sue. I agree with you.
I don't know. I mean, to me, that's...
Since he had a strong reaction to them, we think that they were very bad characters.
Yes. Well, they are very bad.
Right.
Troublemakers.
Right. They're not just simple folks.
Okay.
Right.
They have intention.
They have intention to do harm.
Right.
V'havu ka mitzaro le'tuva. And they were a great cause of distress to him. Hava Kavai Rabbi Meir. Rachame Alaivahu. Rabbi Meir goes and he prays for mercy upon them. Rachame Alaivahu. Ki hechi delimutu. That they should die.
Is this the same thing?
Oh, so that's a good question. What does it mean that someone prays for mercy?
So that they would stop doing more sin. So that if they die, then they would not be worse.
Oh, okay. So one possibility is that they would stop doing sins and it wouldn't be worse for them. Build on that theologically. What we know from our learning together in Sanhedrin, those of us who learn Masechet Sanhedrin, now we'll bring everybody into this theology of the rabbis. What is the rabbinic theology about if you're a thug and you walk around and you steal everything in this life and you get exactly what you want and you walk down the street and no one can bother you because you're stark and you continue to steal and you just live a life of debauchery and you get everything you want and you seem to have it great, right? It's the
Ben Sobel Mouret.
Right, we learned it in that chapter.
So
what was the point about those people and why they got such good stuff in this world? It's not going to go so well, and this is Perek HaChelek, it's not going to go so well for you in Olam Haba.
But if they repent.
In the next world.
No, but if you kill them early enough, then they will go to a good place
right.
In Olam
and
Haba.
And,
that, they will not cause
and that's the so. Mishnah in Sanhedrin
oh, wow.
That says,
yeah.
Yeah, the death of the wicked is a benefit to them.
Right.
Because what Rabbi Meir is trying to do is save their portion in Olam Haba. That is the theological explanation of why it says he's...
I wonder if they believe in Olam Haba.
I wonder.
Okay.
I wonder. Right? But that's what the explanation is theologically, rabbinically. To answer your question. Now, does that theology work? Here's how we're going to see the Gemara saying, does that theology really work? Is that how we're supposed to really have things turn out? And who's going to teach him? His wife, Bruri. Okay.
What are you thinking?
Ma datcha? Amra le Bruria levetu. Bruria, his wife, says to him, Ma datcha? What are you thinking? Mishum dichtiv. After all, it's written in Tehillim, Kuf Dalid. It's written in Psalms 104, Yitamu chataim. Mikativ chotim. It's written like this. Yitamu chata'im. May sins be no more. Is it written chotim? Is it written sinners? You're praying for the sinners to be no more, but it's written in the Psalms, Yitamu chata'im. May sins be no more. Chataim kativ, sins it's written. Va'od, shvil sefer dekra. Let's look at what's written at the end of the verse. Urishaim od einam, and evildoers will be no more. Kevan deyitamu chataim, because sins will be no more. Urishaim od einam. Because sins will be no more, shall we say sinners will be no more? Ela by Rachame Alaihu. So what happened? What should happen by you? Rather, you should pray for mercy upon them. Dilahadaru b'tshuva, that they should return in tshuva. Urishaim odeinam, and they'll be evil doers no more. She teaches him exactly how to reread the psalm in terms of the theological outlook that he should hold and what exactly he should pray for in terms of those who are mitzaru le tuva, in terms of the ones who were giving him such tsuris in his life. Why are they giving him tsuris, by the way? Are they like sneaking into his apartment and stealing his cheese wheel? He's probably the authority in town who can't get these thugs to become, you know, b'nei shchuna. He can't get them to be participants in the rabbinic culture. He can't get them to be good neighbors. He can't find a way in. And so prayer... I'm wondering from this Gemara all the time. Whether or not the mitzare lo tuva was that they would rough him up. They would rough him up. But she tells him, listen, you can't use prayer to pray. And by the way, this whole saving them thing and the merciful thing now so that they can have part of Olam Haba, like, really, is that the way you're going to hold in terms of what our tradition really wants? She brings Psalms, by the way, to impact the way that he actually prays and what he prays for, which is a beautiful use of the Psalm literature, which, again, we say that oftentimes people will say you learn a lot from the Torah, but you can learn a lot by way of the philosophy of Jewish action by the way we read any of the Nach part of the Tanakh, any of the prophets and any of the writings. And she says to them, really pray. And even pray for those people who are mitza'ar lecha, who are really annoying you, who are really, more than that, potentially beating on you, and who are thugs in our neighborhood. By Rachme Alaihu, he did pray for them, for the mercy that she suggested, the Hadru B'tshuva. And they made tshuva. Now.
But at least in the English, you have to tell me. In
yeah.
The English says, let sin cease. That's the English. So you're giving sin an inanimate something, agency.
Well, no, since the sins will cease, there will be no more Rishayim. There won't be any more evildoers. And the evildoers are the Biryoni.
Right, okay.
And so what we're doing is we're asking for the people to really have a channel here towards goodness in this world. Bruria sees this worldliness as the kind of this worldliness that the Jewish people really do see as being so essential. And this notion, I believe, is one of the most important places to make this point. In other words, it's not just about the reward in the next life. And if you remember back to when we had that theological discussion, or this is now, consider it, because, you know, these are big theological ideas here, the Gemara is going to do this in several places, is my point. In other words, it's not just this Masechet Brachot, it's Sanhedrin, it's other places. We're constantly battling. Is there really... the pining after the next world, is that really at the core of who we are, of what we want our tradition to be about? Or are we talking about a tradition that really brings people into touch with refining their ways in this world, creating the kind of community and creating the kind of outlook that we need in order for the world to be b'tshuva, to be returning to goodness and lawful ways?
Well, I think that, you know, if she didn't have the actual knowledge to point out the difference in translation or what it said, I don't think he would have listened so much. I think it just would have been the wife has a different opinion about the way you do it. But because she was able to point out that it's not sinners, it's sin, I think that's what...
No doubt about it. In my mind, that she's now we see that she's inculcated in the way of reading a beginning of a verse and end of a verse. She made a Gemara with two pieces of verses. She could point out exactly what the psalm was saying, in addition to making the connection between this element of the psalm and that element of the psalm. Definitely. She's an inside reader. Now, I want to point out before we move along on these outside pages, I want to bring you to a story that's in Ta'anit. Okay, so there's a parallel. I mentioned this before at the outset. What I meant was this. Sometimes there's a story that's not about Bruria, but it is about Bruria. because in the generations of Jewish women who are themselves going to impact the way we have an out, you know, our Jewish outlooks and the kind of culture that we want to, you know, create and what we value, we're going to see that the stories live on. So what stories do they tell about this kind of sage, that he ultimately, let's take for instance the Chafetz Chaim, that he ultimately said about property that thieves were stealing in his house. This is the 20th century now. That all of its hefker, none of that property is actually mine. Whatever they took, it's not mine. It's simply property that has no owner, because I shouldn't create the opportunity for anyone to become a thief. And, you know, and the guy looks over and says, really? You think the Chafetz Chaim really did that? And the other guy says, well, I don't really know, but I know they're not telling the story like that about me or you. That story is as old as sages are old. But they told that about the 20th century. I think the caveat was 20th century, not the one from ancient times. Anyway, stories.
Stories about her. Do you think that she is a real person, or she becomes a symbol for women?
Oh, I think she's a real person, and I think she becomes a symbol for women. And that's why I want to just go to this story from Tani.
We have to talk about the name.
Ruya is clear God.
Is what?
God is clear. Clear. Ru, Baru is clear. And Nida is a short for God.
Uh-huh. Yeah. They don't really talk about it except to say that there's scholarship that has mentioned such a thing about her name. And that people who put a lot of stake into names...
Yeah.
Versus those who don't, by the way, because there are those who don't, really see her name as being important to the whole picture.
Well, it's a very flattering name. I mean, it's there. She's
someone who needs to make. No doubt. That it's made clear that women have a role through her. That it's made clear that she understands the Torah. So I'm bringing this, as I said, because I want to show you where other stories of another story of a woman lives on. And there's parallel to what we just read. Okay, so if you turn to 23a4, those in English, or at the bottom where I have the arrow. Avachilkia bered Honi Amagel. I mentioned last week what Honi's job was, right? Honi the circle maker?
Right.
It was metaphorical for his drawing a circle in the ground and praying in it and demanding that God listen. It was also that he had a big roller. Okay, and he flattened roofs and floors. Abba Chilkia bar berei de Choni Amagel. Abba Chilkia was a grandson of Choni the circle maker. V'chim et tzarich alma lemitra. And when the world needed rain, right, mitra is matar, divai rachameh, he would pray for mercy. V'ate mitra. And rain would come. Zinachada et tzarich alma lemitra. Once, when the world needed rain, Shador Rabbanan Zuga de Rabbanan Lagabe. The rabbi sent a pair of rabbis to him. Lemibai Rachame Denite Mitra. To ask him to pray for mercy and that the rain should come. Az Elevete Velo Ashkechu. They went to his house, but they didn't find him. Azul Bedavra. They went to the field. The Ashkechu de Chavaka Rafik. They found him hoeing. And they greeted him. Yahavale Shlama. They said Shalom, Shalom. 23b. Two now. No. 23b1 is on the back of that. First English page. 23b1. Okay. So, skipping over a couple of the everything. No, actually, I'm going to go up to the top, and I'll read the whole thing. Lo as bar lehu ape. He didn't welcome them with a smile. No, his grandson. We're talking about his grandson.
Okay.
Abba Chilkia. So what's this thing about a smile, by the way? This thing about a smile is that some sages say that you have to greet everyone with a cheerful countenance. So some cultures really value that. Some cultures really don't value that. Some people really value that. Some people don't. But it's definitely a lesson within Pirkei Avot. Greet everybody with a cheerful countenance. Try to smile. Vafanya, in the evening, ki hava minake tseve, when he gathered up some wood to take it home with him, dare tseve amara bahad katpa, he carried the wood and hoe on one shoulder, uglima bahad kafta, and his cloak on the other shoulder. Kula orchalosia misane, the entire way home he did not wear shoes. Ki mate lamaya sayem misane, when he came to a stream of water, he put on his shoes to cross it. Kimata lechizme vehige, when he came to an area of thorns and thistles, delinahu lamane, he lifted the hem of his clothing, thereby exposing his legs to the thorns. Kimata lamata nafka devitu laape ki mikashta, when he reached the town, his wife came out to meet him adorned with jewelry. Mikashta. So there's the wife. Okay, just to point out that we'll get back to what her presence is. Kimata lavete, when he reached his house, Ala Davitu Beresha, his wife entered first. Vahadar Ayil Ihu, then he entered. Vahadar Ayile Rabbanan, and the rabbis were then invited to enter. Yativ Vicharich Rifta, he then sat down and ate bread. A rifta is a portion of bread. Lo Amar Lahu Rabbanan Tu Krochu, and he didn't say to the rabbis, come and eat. He didn't invite them to join the meal. Palag Rifta Linuke, he portioned bread to the children. L'kashish achada l'zutra tare, to the older child he gave one bread to eat, and to the younger child he gave two. Amar la l'devitu, and then he said quietly to his wife, Yadana d'rabbanan mishum mitra ka'atu, I know that the rabbis have come to ask me to pray for rain. Nisak l'igra v'nibaye rachame, maybe let us go up to the roof and pray for mercy. Okay? So important, the language there. Rabbis came to me to ask, and he says, Nisak la'igra. Let's go up there, the two of us. Efshar demiratze HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'yeti mitra. Perhaps the Holy One, blessed be He, will accept our prayer, and rain will come. V'lo nachazik tivuta l'nafshin. And we will not have to take credit for ourselves for bringing the rain. They went up to the roof. Saku leigra. They go up to the roof. Kam ihu b'chada zavita. He stands at one corner. Ve'iti b'chada zavita. And she stands at another of the corners. Like, kadim salukanane mehach zavita b'dvitu. When the rain came, the clouds arrived earlier from that corner where his wife stood. Ki nachi. When he came down from the roof, Amar lahu amayatu rabbanan, why have the rabbis come? Amrule, they said to him, Shadre lan rabbanan lagabe demar lemibaye rachme amitra. The rabbis sent us to ask you to go pray for mercy, for rain. Amar lahu, he says to them, Baruch hamakom shalo hitzrich etchem l'Abba Chilkiah. Blessed is the omnipresent who didn't require you to depend upon Abba Chilkiah, but sent the rains in their times, before you even had to ask me. Now, as you see the idiomatic little insertion, who's fooling who?
Is Abba Chilkiah his wife?
Abba Chilkiah is the grandson of Koni. His wife is just, his, at this point, the wife. Not named. In other words, he went into the house. He says to his wife, let's go up to the roof to pray. I know those rabbis who were downstairs outside the house came to ask me to pray for rain. But if we go up now...
But the me is Abba Chilkiah.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a little
clear. Clear now?
Yes. The
okay.
Writing is a little unclear.
Yeah, the writing is sometimes unclear.
So why does he decide to eat before he goes to pray?
Very interesting, right? We would say about that...
Very strange, I mean. You've got to indulge yourself before you go talk to God.
Very interesting. And also, there's some traditions that say, before you're really going to pray, shouldn't eat so close to when you're going to pray. Right? So, that's a good question. And the rabbis are going to have lots of questions now, because there seems to be some behaviors here that aren't exactly the expected behaviors. Okay, and that's really what the next couple of paragraphs are going to be. Let's read on. Amrule, they say to him, Yadin on Demetrium Hamat Marhudata. We know the rains become on account of the prayer of the master on your because of your prayers. Ela lehim alan mar, but would the master please explain to us Hani Mile de Tmihalan? A couple of things that are really surprising to us. Okay? Tmiha means that's surprising to us. Okay? And that's a word that becomes very important by way of halachic literature. Tmiha. Surprising here.
Wonder.
We wonder about this. We're puzzled. My tamaki yahivna lamar shalama lo asper lan marape. Why, when we greeted the master, didn't you smile at us? Amar lahu sechir yom haviyai. He said to them, I was hired as a day worker. V'amin alo yi pagar. And I said to myself that since I'm being paid by the day, I shouldn't interrupt my work. In other words, if I smiled at you, then we would have had to start chatting. You know? So what does it mean about smiling? Some people say that this is the place where you learn that just simply greeting everybody with a smile was not what Pirkei Avot meant. It's that if you greet them with a cheerful countenance, you should be prepared to sit and say a little something. Umay tama dera mar, si ve'achad kitape glima achad kitape. They ask him, why did you carry the wood on the one shoulder and the cloak on the other? Amar lahu, he says to them, talit shulaita, it was a borrowed cloak. Right? It wasn't that I was just causing such suffering to myself and carrying it without having the nice cloak on my shoulder. It was a borrowed cloak. Lahachi shali, lahachi lo shali. For this, I borrowed it. In other words, for going to work that day, I borrowed it. For coming home when it was going to get cold at night, I borrowed it. But not for actually making it the cloak upon which I should rest. The wood. My tamakula orecha lo siyam mar misane. And why is it the entire way home the master didn't wear his shoes? Why didn't you put your shoes on? Except for when he was crossing the, where was that? He was crossing the water. Vechi matid amayya sayim simane. And when you did get to the water, you put your sandals on. Amalo, he says to them, kula orecha chazina. The entire way I could see where I was stepping and I didn't require the protection of my shoes. You know? This was a way to what? Preserve the shoes. He's also not in possession of his own cloak. He's obviously a person who's what?
Poor.
He's a poor person. But Maya loka chazina. I couldn't see where I was going to really step in the water. And therefore I needed some protection on my shoes. On my feet. My tamakimata mar lechizme vehige delinhu lamane. And why, when you came to the area of thorns and thistles, did you lift up your clothing and expose your legs? I mean, there were thorns and thistles there. Amar lahu, he says to them, ze male arucha, this, my leg heals. The ze, ena male arucha. And this garment, it doesn't get fixed up so quickly. Right? The whole notion of having clothes like we have clothes was not something that people really knew from if you had less. Right? Mahi tamaki mata mar lamata nafka devetu demar ki mikashta. Why then, master, when your master reached the town, did the master's wife come out to greet him adorned with jewelry? That doesn't seem to fit in this whole picture of what you're explaining. Amarlo, he says to them, Kadeshalo eten einai b'isha acheret. So I shouldn't have any desire to glance at another woman.
It's interesting, this is in Hebrew and the rest is in Aramaic.
Very interesting, right?
Yeah.
He says it goes right back to Aramaic.
That is probably a reason.
Maybe. But here we have a notion of this kind of... What's that?
So she wouldn't understand. She presumably spoke Aramaic.
Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I think that you have a really interesting comment about the notion of what is the man's problem here. He admits it. In other places in about tefillah, it's always so she shouldn't arouse such suspicion, or she shouldn't be there. Here he's like, so I won't put my eyes on anybody else.
But it was allowed at that time, so I don't know.
Well, not in that way. No, we already said we're dealing mostly with monogamy and mostly with people who are very connected to each other. Allowed or not allowed. My Tama Ayel Ahi Bereisha. They asked him, did you go and enter first? V'hadar Ayel Mar, your wife enter first. V'hadar Ayel Mar Abatra. And then the master enter after her. V'hadar Ilayin in Anin. And then when we arrived to enter, Amar Lahu, he said to them, Mishum Delo Bidikituli. Because your character was not really known to me. So in other words, why didn't you ask us to come in and eat? Well, I had to go, take care of my own. Meaning what?
Children.
He has children, and he's got to make sure that they've got enough for them. My tama ki karich marifta velo amar lan itu karuche. Why didn't you say come and eat? Mishum de lo nefisha rifta, because there was clearly not enough bread. And I wasn't trying to have you say, no, we'll wait out here and get you to be, I wasn't going to try to create in you the need to be generous towards me. I didn't want you to really have to produce that generosity on my account. That's his reason. My tama yahiv marli nuka kashisha hadarifta lazutra dari. And why did the master give the older child only one bread to eat and to the younger child two breads? Amalahu, hai kai baveta. The one stays home during the day and he's able to eat something, so he needed less. Vahayati bave kanishta, and this one goes to the synagogue all day studying Torah and is there for prayer and he's hungrier. Umay tamakadim saluganim hazavita dehave kaima devitu demar la anana dide. And why did the clouds arrive earlier in the corner where the master's wife was standing than the clouds of the master? So this is an interesting question about the power of the woman's prayer here.
Yeah, but Kadima could be east, so it could be that the way the clouds are coming usually in that area.
Here it's understood as it got to her corner first. Got to her corner first. Mishum de'itita shechicha beveta. He replied, because a woman is generally present in the house, and she's able to give bread to poor people when they are in need, and its benefit is more immediate. In other words, she does the mitzvah of taking care of the poor more directly than I could ever do. And in her commentary, that's the way that Hillel's wife, now with another text, Hillel's wife, teaches Hillel how to do tzedakah. Because when they don't even look like they have enough, she's willing to give the man a bowl of soup at the door, while he said, I don't know if we can. So there's all kinds of intertext going on here with this story, with this woman. Whereas I give money to the poor and its benefit is not immediate. Inami, we also could say, alternatively, Hanhu biryone dahavu b'shiva vutan, there were these boors, or there were these thugs, or there were these bandits,
ruffians,
I like that. That's a new one to our lexicon. Yeah. Ana ba'i rachame de lemutu, I prayed that they should die, right? V'hi ba'i rachame de lehiadru b'tiyuvta, but she prayed that they should repent.
So, is this Bruria?
Oh.
But she wasn't.
It's not. It's not Bruria. And it's not Bruria giving the limud, it's not Bruria giving the lesson about the Tehillim, it's this woman living in the image of Bruria and Rabbi Meir, and ultimately coming and she herself praying that they should repent. What? The Ahadaru. And it's in brackets because why? some of the manuscripts have it, and some of the manuscripts don't. And there is, you know, the reality check. Okay, are they going to accept that the woman prayed as efficaciously as Rabbi Meir did? And the answer, of course, is yes, because it makes it into the Vilna, even if it's in brackets. Sometimes we just do what's called read on through. You read what's there. And you have this story now where you see very, very closely that this sage, who wore his poverty on his sleeve in many ways and thought that that was such a great sign of what it meant to be sagacious and the one whose merit really allowed for the prayers to be heard, that he needed his wife to define culturally how the house should ultimately be a house of tzedakah, and even with prayer, what would ultimately earn you the great merit of having rain fall in its time and having others respond with tshuva if you prayed for them. So we don't get her name, which is an interesting piece here, and seems to me to be lacking, and I want to know. I want to know. But it's an incredible story that has some intertextual kind of parallel to what's going on.
They're using the same language, so the question is, who came first? Mm-hmm. And maybe Bruria is just a figure of, not a real person.
So you could make the argument, if you wanted to go some into the whole landscape of Masechtot, Tanit seems to be an earlier tractate in many cases than other tractates, so you could say, yeah, you could say, well, no, I don't know, so I'm not claiming. You could say that Tanit, the tractate that this is from, is something that's got a lot of early material in it. I'm just not sure that the Agadita, that the stories of Honi and the stories of Honi's grandchildren, which were in here in the 20s, are really that early. I don't know that.
It would be after Bruria, you see.
Yeah, and material in Brachot and Pesachim could also very well be early. So the early, the late. There are those who can talk to it further. If you're really interested in the scholarship of which fragments and segments and things are really before or after, based on language, I'm not going to claim, but I will say that intertextually they are all in dialogue with each other, and where the Bruria text has her, the sage who can create the lesson with the actual text of the Bible in dialogue with the very, very particular authorities, this one is about the generations forward of people who are really relied upon by the sages themselves, who have learned how to ultimately gain merit for the entire Jewish people. This is not a sage arguing with a wife. This is the grandson of Honi, who has a righteous wife, whose actions, whose prayers are rewarded. So there's a culture here of, I think, a little bit more the culture of women in the home who are learned versus just the one with access because she's Rabbi Meir's wife and she's Hananya ben Sharadyan's daughter.
You know, but there is a conflict because Isha Tzadikah doesn't need to put jewelry on her because of power, you know, it's a little bit...
I think that jewelry, if you push me further on the jewelry, because I wasn't going to go here with the next source, but I had another source lined up, which I think is an intertextual source, and I'd have to do a little bit more reading than what came to me this week. But here's where I went with jewelry. So what's jewelry all about in the tradition? The primary place where I think about jewelry actually relates to this week's parsha.
Masana, I think of jewelry is the golden.
Yeah, so oppositely, there's a great midrash that says all the women really never gave it up. And for their merit, yeah, they didn't give up their jewelry. And they didn't give it up willingly. And for their merit,
because they didn't contribute to the golden calf,
we really received the promise of generations to come. So even though we promised
that jewelry come from the Egyptians,
of course, because we
okay,
lived.
So let's just acknowledge that reparation.
We lived a decent material life there, I think, more than it was forced reparation.
So Rabbi's saying not only not just giving it to them, that they had them before.
The women didn't participate in the Egel scenario. That's the reason they can keep the jewelry until
but
today.
I'm arguing that the jewelry that they kept itself had a somewhat of a nefarious beginning.
And what I'm arguing is that the general outlook that we took that as self-proclaimed restorative justice reparations or nefarious material reparations was actually because we lived actually pretty, at least a class of Jews, potential Jewish people who left Egypt with Moses, we led a pretty decent material life. And that slavery, as we understand it, that we've thought about it for so long, slavery needs to be looked at again in terms of what it meant to be a class of what it meant to be a class of avadim. And that class structure where we were not necessarily in charge of governmental policy, where so all of that gold that they left with and all the potential building materials that we have for the Mishkan, I think are tied in with that whole material culture that must have existed. And the blessing is, in terms of the jewelry piece, just to get back to around your statement, why does she need it? I think there's a beautiful sense of jewelry. Some rabbinic stories, Rabbi Akiva buys Rachel a beautiful tiara, which is called the Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Jerusalem of Gold. And that's what he wants for her after he's been learning Torah and he wants to bring back. But she herself is a learned soul who respects Torah so much that she sends him off to become from a shepherd to a great teacher of students. And she's adorned with this beautiful gold because the engagement with material life, if you're going to have it radiate a certain light of Torah, I think it's accepted and celebrated by the rabbis.
The thing that bothers me here is, his wife has jewelry with which to adorn herself, but they don't have enough money that he can wear his shoes most of the time, and he has to, allow his skin to be injured rather than risking damage to his
cloak.
Yeah,
I agree that if you wanted to say, there should be some great system of, maybe they could have sold something. Maybe let's look at what some people hold on to as heirloom jewelry. Let's look at what some people hold on to that makes them feel pride. Amy spends a lot of time up and down the six, the 4, 5, 6 line.
The subway.
Oh. And she goes and visits patients who, at the end of their lives, they're many of them, some of them, struggling deeply to get food on the table. But they have a few things in their homes that make them feel just dignified. And I think that that's a piece of what is being said here about the culture of that household, as opposed to my being bothered with it. I could if they're not managing the house right, if there was some kind of, obligation that they weren't taking care of.
Well, from the standpoint that she's clearly being held out as someone who's connected to God and she's being portrayed in a positive light. That's why it contrasts.
Yeah, I hear you. It's an interesting piece to read within the context of the whole story.
But I have to apply jewelry. Kishut.
I don't think there's anything else that anybody said that I saw so far, but I'll look at it now that you mention it.
So
I think
every
Jewish woman has, in our time now, wearing jewelry the way people did a generation or two ago, never mind thousands of years ago. Today it seems a little bit irrelevant, like to give my grandmother's bracelet to my daughter's daughters. But actually, I'm talking about wealthy people. When you went to bar mitzvah or whatever, they all had a bracelet, a brooch, and a ring. Everybody had that.
Yeah, my family was like that too. Yeah. My grandmother had certain pieces that were really, really special pieces.
And I think what's interesting is they didn't have the association. She could give charity to people who came.
Right.
She could do these things and put on her necklace. It was, I think it was like the obligation to make Sabbath beautiful.
Right.
I mean, this is kind
right.
of a beautifying obligation that did not make you selfish. It
no.
made
yeah.
you...
Yeah.
And her husband's very proud of her.
Yeah.
And so he's happy to take his shortcuts to save money, to economize, so that the wife can.
Well, it might have been her obligation to look nice, it's his
right.
obligation to go and work and get, you
know,
the rest of the child.
Share with you all, we have one of the sets of the Ur jewelry, so that's the 2000, it's from the Chaldean.
Abraham.
From Abraham. And the jewelry is not only big, but it's robust. And they deliberately go out of their ways to bring things from as far as possible. So we have lapis lazuli from Afghanistan, the only source. So jewelry has a very, very long history in human nature of what it means and what it presents. I mean, there's so much of it. It is the wealth of the nation. But it's a very poignant statement, I think, that transcends civilizations, and we
agreed.
Can see it. We
agreed.
Can see it manifest.
By the way, it's for men, too. I'll just end with this. I was reading a tshuva this past week about how you make Shabbos beautiful if you don't have much clothing, because I was interested also in this notion of this cloak thing really touched me. Really touched me. You know, one cloak, and he's saving the cloak because he borrowed it. And anyway, so what does a person do if they only had one shirt for Shabbos? This was an 18th century. This was an 18th century reflection. So you'd wash it, and for Shabbat it would be the only day that you could roll down the sleeves, because all week, and then the sleeves
would be clean. You'd have white cuffs.
You'd have
clean cuffs.
Beautiful cuffs, and they were cut like what we call French cuff. And people had Shabbat jewelry, and the way you adorned yourself was to put cufflinks in.
Yeah.
And it was a discussion about how men also had the right jewelry for the day.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's...
Rolled up, it was because you could work or because you had to put the filling on?
Because you had to work and you didn't want to get things dirty.
You want to preserve the cuff, Bobby, so just go to all the portraits. How do you tell someone who isn't a worker? Because they have white cuffs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
great to learn with you. And
see you
next week.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.